It's the Burning Fat edition of Radio Free Thinker. This week, Doping the Olympics, Why Some Christians Homeschool, interview with Ed Falzon, author of Being Gay is Disgusting. Let's begin episode 174.
It's time for Radio Free Thinker, the show that applies skepticism and critical thinking to everyday issues. The place where reason and reality cross swords with politics, religion, economics, and of course, science. Now let's get ready to be skeptical.
The cosmos is also within us. We're made of sparks. We are aware of the cosmos can know itself.
Across the sea of space, the stars are other suns. We've traveled this way before, and there is much to be learned.
Hello, and welcome to Radio Free Thinker, the radio show podcast that promotes skepticism and critical thinking right here on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. My name is Ethan, your free thinking historian.
Are you? Are you really? Well, this is Dawn, your skeptical philosopher, political scientist. Ethan, I am so sick of hearing about this, but you know, somehow I just feel like we have to mention it, at least in a token sense. Have you heard that the Higgs boson has been found? I mean, Higgs boson.
You mean the God particle?
Yes, which really wasn't the God particle. Apparently it was the goddamn particle, as in, goddamn, we found it, but they couldn't publish that, so it became the God particle.
Well, it can't be the God particle because it exists.
Yes, I hadn't thought to go there. So yes, no, apparently they have found something that is supposed to be what they think is going to be the Higgs boson. They're not quite sure. Me and Ethan, before the show, were kind of briefly announcing that although we've heard a lot about the Higgs boson, it's supposed to give you gravity. We really don't understand exactly how, because there's supposed to be like this field, but if it's a field, how can it be made of particles? Actually, I saw the best example yet to explain this on a BBC show where they had, imagine you had all these particles, little round balls on a flat table, and they move around hiddly-giddly, right? There's no real attractive force or confining force. But now imagine you put on that sand. And in some areas you have deeper sand, in other areas you have lower sand. And that's sort of the Higgs field. As the deeper something sinks into this field, the heavier it is, and the more it sits on the surface, the lighter it is. One thing I've never quite understood, and I know you're really well read up on physics, cosmology, Ethan, so I'm assuming you're going to help this. So they take two particles together, they slam them together, and they create a Higgs boson, right? So it's like we take a whole bunch of stuff together and we have enough energy to create a Higgs boson, and then that's supposed to decay. But if Higgs bosons decay in nature, then how can Higgs bosons exist in nature? That's always got me confused, because I know, you know, they have like these, you know, atomic elements that are like, you know, 116 protons big, right? And they last for a few seconds and they disappear because they decay. So the Higgs boson decays into other quarks and that sort of thing. That means that they shouldn't really exist in nature then, should they?
Well, you know, the answer to that question is really complicated to explain, so I can't really give you an answer to it. Otherwise, I think if you actually explain the Higgs boson properly, the whole universe implodes.
Yes.
Well, I better not explain it, just be on the safe side.
Yes, there's some small whiffs of smoke coming out of Ethan's ear, and I would mock him for that, but I must confess the same whiffs are coming out of my ears. It's one of those things that if you understand quantum mechanics, quantum physics, you probably don't understand it at all. But things that I do understand is the Olympics.
Really?
Well, I kind of do. There's some things that do confuse me, and we're going to talk about some of that because, you know, with the Olympics around the corner, I thought it'd be a good time for us to go into some of the, you know, Olympic-themed type topics. Many may remember the glory and the shame of Ben Johnson, who set a world sprint record only to have it stripped away 2 days later in the 1988 Olympics, I believe it was.
Possibly, yes.
That time period. Because he tested positive for steroids. As it actually turned out, five of the runners in that race eventually were found to be taking some form of banned substance. So it was quite a big thing. But more importantly for us, it's kind of when the whole idea of Olympic doping came into the common Canadian psychic. Now, of course, you know, drug doping is sort of what we non-technical types would refer to as performance-enhancing drugs. But of course, in one sense, I have to say sort of, what is the fuss? On the one level, it seems somehow wrong that, you know, a person should be able to gain an unfair advantage by taking one drug or the other. But why is it wrong or not when one person has, you know, better equipment, better training facilities, more economic support, and all the drugs are sort of equally unfair? So, you know, some things are considered to be, well, that's okay, even though it's not equal, but drugs, oh, they're all bad. So I thought first, let's go into sort of the, like what we're going to talk about with regards to some of the drugs here. And granted, a lot of what I'm going to say, or we're going to discuss here, are not sort of definitive things. They're almost like, well, these questions come up, and I'm curious to know what our listening audience has to say about this, and we appreciate feedback. We have one more show before the Olympic Games begin, and we shouldn't limit it to just Olympic pre-game shows, but what do you think about some of these topics we're going to run about? So the first sort of level of drugs is what I kind of refer to as the hard drugs, like anabolic steroids. These are the ones made famous by the East German women's Olympics teams because the women had bigger beards than the West German men's teams did. They work by introducing testosterone or other such sex hormones into the person's system with the belief that they will increase male traits like strength, endurance, and that sort of thing. Actually, ironically enough, thanks to the work that was done by the East German team, which were using anabolic steroids for a long time, we actually know that these do have an effect on the body, but then again, only to a degree. Women notice the most improvement, as well as under sort of developed men. And the women do largely because there's this like range of body possibilities. And the female range is smaller than the male range. And if you push the women into sort of the male domain, they at least get to the top end of the female range and they begin to seep over into the middle area of the male range. So you do get a lot of dramatic increases in strength and that sort of thing. However, there's less evidence for that there's any kind of real improvement for peak athletes. And they also kind of come with a lot of severe side effects. So they've largely pretty much disappeared from the scene. The next group are what I would actually classify as soft drugs. And this is not so much moral, but this is sort of the effects that they may have on you. And this is like human growth hormone. This is sort of currently the big thing. Now, in theory, these are supposed to be as effective as steroids, but without the side effects. However, from what I've been reading and hearing, the scientific evidence for their efficacy is pretty limited.
If I can interrupt there, one of the things with human growth hormones is that there seems to be a lot of disagreement even within the sporting fields of what exactly they do. Because one of the reasons why this particular drug is popular is because a lot of the so-called baseball superstars have all been testifying that they've been taking this sort of thing, Barry Bonds and, you know, these other fellows. And it's not really clear what exactly these things are supposed to do because they seem to be using them for radically different purposes.
Well, actually, and that's one of the things that comes into this. I mean, from what I've been hearing, the big thing that they do is they actually increase water retention. So you kind of get bigger muscles, but it's not actually bigger muscle mass. It's bigger muscle aqueous, right? Now, actually, and both of these drugs, they do actually can have a noticeable effect on non-professionals. And I might say that, you know, the Barry Bonds of the world may actually fall into this sort of range. So let's say, you know, if you or I were to take some of these drugs, well, there would likely be a marked change. However, Olympic-level athletes are sort of already at the peak of their physical capacity. So really, the effect seems to be of these drugs is more as a placebo effect. And apparently, they can have a huge placebo effect on people.
So are you suggesting that baseball players are not in peak physical shape?
Yes, I am. Although, to be fair, compared to bowlers, they maybe seem to be slightly more in shape than that. Mm-hmm. But the point being, I mean, to be fair, one of the things that Barry Bonds and them were noted for is, you know, they seem to bulk out, right?
Yeah.
Well, baseball players are not known as weightlifters. I mean, that's not sort of their area of expertise. So if they were taking these and they were amplifying their weightlifting ability, they had room to grow, so to speak. But someone like Ben Johnson, we mentioned at the beginning, he probably already had gotten the maximum amount of muscle mass he could under normal circumstances. And there's also the type of thing that you can get where you get sort of the deleterious effects, which obviously sports players don't want to have. If you take note that things like chicken gets pumped up with some growth hormones to increase their size, and literally they can break their bones and that sort of thing because they have too much muscle for their body to withstand.
Right.
And it is, to be fair, hard to tell some of the effects of these soft drugs or the hard drugs, because it's hard to literally do the test. I mean, you know, athletes don't want to be guinea pigs because the minute they take them, they're disqualified from competition. And a lot of them, Lance Armstrong, and there was another bicyclist out there, are taking sort of a plethora of drugs, right? So they're taking five or six different ones. And even if you kind of know what one or two of them might do, you have no idea what the general effect will be by taking them all.
Yeah, and one of the other things with side effects too is that it's so poorly understood what drugs are being taken that people will attribute side effects that aren't possible with certain not all steroids, but certain performance-enhancing drugs. So the classic example is roid rage, where, you know, steroids are supposed to make you like crazy. And there's been reports, you know, like particularly like wrestlers in the news where they kind of lose it and like murder their families. And everybody says, oh, it's roid rage. But a lot of times the drugs that they're taking are not the kind that would cause that reaction. They're something totally different, which means they're just crazy for a different reason. But a lot of the times we hear about side effects like, oh, don't be like Barry Bonds because you're going to get roid rage. Well, Barry Bonds didn't take steroids. I mean, as far as we know, he took other performing enhancing drugs.
Well, and that also falls into sort of the classic stereotypes, like testosterone is supposed to make you more aggressive because it's the man drug. Mm-hmm. But that ignores the fact that everyone has a certain level of testosterone, and even people who have high testosterone naturally don't necessarily have any of these sort of super maleness effects on them.
Yeah, they don't hulk out the way that roid rage sort of implies.
And that just, it leads to the fact that humans are very complex entities, and we don't have a large understanding of how our growth really takes place in the massive complexity that it comes in real life. Another level of drugs that are sort of big in the news at the moment are those that sort of change the body's ability to, the ones we've been looking at change the body's ability to improve itself. So it's building muscle, it's making more of this, making more of that. The next level of group sort of improves the ability for the body to supply things. So the big one is blood doping. And this is the one that Lance Armstrong has been accused of. Blood doping can be anything, is anything that really increases the amount of blood in your body system. Early attempts to do this involved actually blood transfusions to literally put more blood in there. Currently, there are drugs out there that actually increases the body's ability to produce red blood cells. And the idea is that the more oxygen you have in your system, the more endurance you have, the longer you can last before you collapse.
This is the one that a lot of hockey players are accused of using. And there's been much to do about nothing, but we're not quite sure about how much this would actually help, or how this would help an athlete compared to, say, standard steroids that we're more familiar with. Because this one, especially for a sport like hockey that's a lot of cardio, this one could be really beneficial if you can last longer, so to speak, than your opponent could. Regardless of having muscles, this is your ability, your endurance, really.
Well, and actually, see, that brings up another interesting, and as you mentioned, there's sort of a lot of complex and contradictions here. Because in hockey in particular, the amount of time that any particular player stays on the ice in a modern game is, I think, a few minutes. Relatively short period of time. If you go back to, like, the 60s or the 70s, players would be out for 15, 30 minutes at a time, right? And I mean, so, you know, do you really want them out there longer when it seems to be the trend is to have them sort of quick flash back, you know, this sort of that sort of train? Another example, and this may actually give the Olympics the nickname of the Purple Pea Games. That's because recent research has shown that an increased intake of nitrates found in veggies like beets, ergo purple pea, increases nitrous oxide in the blood. Nitrous oxide has been shown to improve long-distance performance and stamina. And they're not quite sure how it does it, but it certainly seems to have some minor effect. So they're expecting that all the urine samples to be handed in are going to be a slightly different color than your standard yellow. Currently, beets are not banned, but you may be surprised to know that capsaicin, yes, that's, you know, chili peppers, actually are banned, at least for horses, because apparently they're supposed to have a numbing effect on horses' things. But again, this is sort of, now we've expanded what we classify as a drug to be a much larger sort of, if you're banned. The last group are what I would call sort of catalysts. And these are ones that usually are seen to be pretty much unfair to have to some degree or not, but they're like pep pills. They allow the body to do whatever it normally does, but to do it faster and longer. Think of like amphetamines or caffeine, you know, PCB, that sort of thing. Although actually caffeine itself disqualified an athlete in 1972 games, it is now, of course, quite legal, although amphetamines are still banned. And I guess that's actually a good thing. There are generally believed to be sort of three rules that the Olympic Committee considers when it's going to ban a drug or not. One, is it harmful to the athlete? And again, that seems to be kind of a no-brainer on one level. Does it provide an advantage? So do I take this and does it actually improve my performance? And is it sort of unsportsmanlike? Sort of like, does it break the sort of spirit of the games? And this is one of the ones that can be very, very iffy because there's no real definition as to what is unsportsmanlike or what is sort of the, in keeping with the spirit of the games. And that's why a lot of times there's controversies arise, like caffeine. Why is caffeine wrong, but some amphetamines bad, right? Mm-hmm. So why is one good, one why not the other? And apparently the idea is if you break any two of these, it's considered to be a banned substance. One point is often raised is that we need to protect athletes from the harms of drugs like steroids, amphetamines, that sort of thing. It's funny, though, because on the one level, you know, it seems wrong. But then again, we're quite willing to sit back and let an athlete abuse their body physically, but not chemically. I mean, if you think of the deleterious effects of hard training, you know, you get pulled muscle, torn ligaments, broken bones, the long-term wear and tear on their skeletal system and that sort of thing. That's okay. We don't care if you kill yourself by working your body to death, but don't you dare take that capsaicin pill or what have you. So that said, I mean, I don't want athletes to sort of go down the path where they're always, you know, increasingly taking more and more different kinds of drugs because, I mean, it's not an all or nothing sort of thing. But at the same time, it seems weird that we have this sort of weird ethos around drugs itself, and all this for the sake of Olympic spectacle. Now, the controversy arises sort of in three ways, and I've kind of gone over a bit of this before, so I'm not going to reiterate it too much. But the whole idea is, you know, drugs seem to be bad, but when it comes to other things, like there was a famous controversy a couple of years back, I think 2008 Beijing Games, where the American Olympic sports team came out in these sort of shark-finned swimsuits. And that was seen as like, oh, that's okay, sort of, but it's really sort of unfair. I mean, as it turns out, I don't think they're legal now. But it shows that, you know, why are we treating drugs so differently from the other disadvantages? I mean, shouldn't we allow athletes to become all that they can be, no matter sort of what they have? In fact, one of the weirdest things that I heard about this, and this will be my last comment on this, is apparently the London Games are pushing this sort of drug mentality to sort of a new limit where they're going to be holding the samples for up to 8 years so that if a new test comes up or if there's a new substance that's found to be an unfair advantage, the athletes can then be retested and they can actually have their medals taken away long after the games are over. So really, in a weird sort of way, the London Olympics are not going to really 2012 Olympics, but the 2020 Olympics. So I've run out of steam on that one, Ethan. Any comments?
Well, I mean, I think we sort of hit the main points on that one. I am curious to see what other people will think about this. So, you know, we do encourage our listeners to write in and tell us how we're wrong. info@radiofreethinker.com is that email address. We should go to a commercial break here on CITR 101.9 FM. And stay tuned. We have more after this.
Okay, last week we started talking about the diseducation of homeschool children who follow the Accelerated Christian Education Curriculum, often referred to as ACE. This week we're going to ask the question, why would the parents allow their children to be diseducated? What is really being taught with these courses and why? I believe it can be summed up in one quote by Arthur Ryderich, a representative of the Christian Education Europe, when he said, quote, "We might be viewed as not being balanced, but we can see where the alternative is leading. It is simply going to be, parents, you don't indoctrinate your children because we want to indoctrinate your children. That I just can't tolerate," he said. What he's saying is that they have a particular worldview, and if they let their children attend regular school, they may be exposed to points of view, and in their mind, literally, God forbid, facts that may call into question the worldview of their parents. One way, of course, you could look at this is to allow your children to get a good education and confront their questions with the aim of everyone becoming a better human being. Or you could shelter them from reality and indoctrinate them so that they will remain stunted humans. One of the common themes in the ACE curriculum is the emphasis on rote memory. The questions asked are almost always fill-in-the-blank or multiple choice. There is no attempt to teach the children the meaning or understanding of a lesson. What is all that is required is that you remember the facts, quote, and regurgitate them mindlessly on demand, emphasis on mindlessly. In a very real sense, these children will lack the cognitive ability to think properly. It is a testament to the resiliency of the human mind that most do not actually remain in this retarded intellectual state. However, what is accomplished is the reflex to accept things without thinking, to reiterate without critical thought, and to compartmentalize their sort of first learning whenever it may come into conflict with reality. The language used also reinforces the authoritarian nature of religion in general. Children are not told to listen to their parents, to follow the laws, to be good people. No, they are told to obey. Obey your God, obey your pastor, obey your parents. Whatever they tell you to do, you do without question. To question or to disobey is a sin. There are two illustrations in the ACE curriculum that I looked at, anyhow, in particular that I thought was sort of indicative of this mindset. One is a son helping his father, not because it's a good thing, not because he likes to help dad. No, the punchline is, quote, God commands me to like to help others, end quote. Another illustration they had is a teacher talking to some children. Teacher, children, obey your parents in the Lord, for this is right. Students, when your parents tell you to bring your raincoat, you must obey. Yes, Becky? Becky says, what if it doesn't rain? Teacher responds, the scriptures say if you obey, you will have a long life. If it best to obey. Parents are wiser than children. Yes, Becky. Oh, thank you, teacher. You are wise too. You persuade us to do the right thing by teaching us God's word. Now, that last is important to maintain control after children grow up. I mean, you should always obey your parents. And some of us might say, okay, well, that's kind of good on the surface. But it goes deeper when you go into a sort of Christian background, because it sort of follows that God is the father of all. So you should always obey God's word. But not only do we know God's word, but we should also follow what he says in the Bible and what the pastor tells you to do, because he's sort of God's elect on the earth. ACE Vice President Ronald Johnson stated, we do not believe that education should be non-directive or speculative, or that the final interpretation of facts and events should be left up to immature, inexperienced minds. ACE's view on truth can be summed up by this comment about science. True science will never contradict the Bible, because God created both the universe and the scriptures. If a scientific theory contradicts the Bible, then the theory is wrong and must be discarded. To all of us here who are sort of skeptically minded, we are rolling our eyes, barfing, doing whatever we want. But this provides the parents in the home, the pastor in the community, and the church in all things, the best go-to line of all time. It's God's will. Unlike science, which strives to answer questions, religion has all the answers. Well, not the answers for saying, you know, not really answers, it's just God did it, which really doesn't tell you anything about what's going on. It just gives you an endpoint to discussion, an endpoint to intellectual experimentation. But it also provides you with the unquestionable authority, and people must obey their commands because God told you to do it. Why did God tell you to do it? Because God's will. God just knows everything. This is a pervasive fear, I think, and it comes through into why parents would do this, is that independence may break out. What if we allow some of the bricks in the wall of ignorance to be removed, like evolution, climate change, solar fusion? Then the wall of ignorance may collapse. If that happens, they fear that they will no longer be in control, and that if that is the, and that's sort of the worst fate of all, it's damnation in their mind. So really, the whole point of the ACE sort of curriculum is to create mindless automatons that follow orders on command, essentially. Mm-hmm. And you sit there and you say, well, why would a parent do that? Well, one, the parent himself has been brought up in this sort of educational environment. So their pastor tells them this is the right thing to do. So in one sense, they are just falling on a tradition. But, and this is where I'm going to give them a bit of slack, and I would give libertarians this, I'd give, you know, social communist type people who may homeschool their children a bit, is that they fear the world they see around them. I mean, there's change in the world. There's violence in the world. There's sex in the world. And you want to protect your children as much from that. And you may see that one way to protect them from all this is to create these intellectual walls around them. And if you do that, then they will somehow be immune from all the, quote, horrors that you see infesting the world. Now, of course, that is sort of proven wrong. I mean, the scientific method, critical thinking, is the best way to prevent yourself from being abused from a society at large. But if you live in the bubble, if you live in the sheltered society, you just think, okay, you know, if they don't know about it, it can't hurt them.
Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, that is just not true. What they don't understand will hurt them. And that's kind of the tragedy of any kind of insular-focused education system like the one that you're talking about. And actually, it plays into our upcoming interview with Edward Fazan about sort of that kind of twisted morality that exists in the Bible, and trying to make the Bible sort of a scientific, reality-based document as opposed to a book of fairy tales. So we'll go to a commercial here. When we come back, we'll have our interview with Edward. Very interesting. I encourage you to listen to it. And he's got a talk coming up at UBC. We'll mention that after the interview. So stay tuned. Subscribe to the Radio Free Thinker podcast and take it on the go and download previous episodes. Subscribe via iTunes or at radiofreethinker.com. Remember to like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at CITRRFT. If you have any questions, comments, or thoughts to share with us, email at info@radiofreethinker.com. Understanding empowers you. Joining us now on Radio Free Thinker is Edward Fazan, the author of Being Gay is Disgusting, or God Likes the Smell of Burning Fat. Welcome to the show, Edward.
Hello, thanks for having me.
So, Edward, you're giving a talk for the UBC Free Thinkers on July 18th entitled No One Follows the Bible, which leads me to my first question. What makes you say that?
Well, I think it's objectively obvious that we can observe in any society, almost anywhere in the world, but certainly everywhere in the Western world, that people are not following the Bible. And this is a good thing, of course. The Bible is a horribly nasty, violent piece of work. Even the Fred Phelpses of the world, who claim to take the Bible literally, and they tell you that God hates you because you're gay or because you tolerate gay people, but they're not suggesting for a moment that we should introduce the death penalty for children who disobey their parents. So people are only selectively choosing the parts of the Bible with which they agree. And this is not following the Bible.
So tell us a bit about your background. What led you to research the Bible in the first place?
It goes back to when I was dating. Quite accidentally, I went on a date with a born-again Christian. I didn't know she was born-again Christian until she started talking about how she didn't get the whole Trinity idea until she saw three tree trunks that blended into a single tree up at the branches, the higher branches. And when she started praying at dinner in a restaurant, I thought it was a bit strange. So I thought, okay, well, I'll start reading and see where that takes me. I wasn't specifically interested in converting, although I was raised Catholic. I was agnostic at the time. But I started reading the Bible, and just on the first page, you start thinking, this cannot be written by a terribly wise or all-knowing entity. Couldn't even be influenced. I mean, we're talking about, you know, the moon is a source of light, the stars are inside the sky of Earth, above which there's water so that it can rain, and this is all on page one. Whales are at least implied to be fish on page one, and are mentioned as fish later in the book. It's objectively false from almost start to finish. So I continued reading, and she and I really parted company fairly early on. But I kept reading and realized why so many people don't read the Bible. It's a very boring book to read. And so what I decided to do was to start paraphrasing the entire book. It's a very long book, so it's like more than 500,000 words. So the first book, Being Gay is Disgusting, is the five books of Moses, which constitutes about 20% of the whole book, the whole Bible, the Protestant Bible, I should say. And over the next year or two, I'll actually be writing the entire series of five.
And so during your research, you mentioned you looked at the first books of Moses. Did you look at other holy books or early church documents? And if you did, what was the most surprising thing that you found?
Well, there are plenty of surprising things in the Bible itself. I've concentrated my research to biblical documents. I haven't gone off to the Quran just yet, although I intend to. I don't think any sacred book is more sacred than any other sacred book. But my upbringing is Catholicism. I'm surrounded by Christians in the Western world, and so I don't really know much about the Quran or Buddhism or Shintoism. But my focus is on the Bible. The most atrocious thing I've seen in the Bible is probably when the army commanders of the Israelite camp slaughtered an entire town for the horrible crime of converting some of the Israelites away from Judaism. And they killed all the men and any boy capable of carrying a sword and took hostage all of the women and children. When they brought them back to camp, this is in Numbers 31 if you want to play at home, but when they brought them back to camp, Moses actually got angry and said, "Why did you let the women live? They're the ones who were converting our men." And he ordered the women to be killed except for the virgins. He ordered the young boys and infants to be killed as well, but only the virgins remained, 32,000 of them, 32 of which were offered up to the Lord, and I'm not yet prepared to say that that was a human sacrifice, although it can certainly be implied. And the other close to 32,000 women were divided up amongst the Israelite camps for sexual slavery. That's about the most atrocious thing I've ever read. And it would make Hitler blush, for goodness sake.
Based on your research, you would suggest that despite people who claim to be true believers and follow the Bible, if they did, they would basically be morally reprehensible people, potentially committing lots and lots of crimes.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. All you have to do is look at the people who are following the Bible more closely than the norm and see just how they're behaving. And you think, well, this is at odds with human well-being. It is at odds with society in general. We're talking about Fred Phelps, who shows up at the funeral of a soldier with a young wife dressed in black and a mother dressed in black and the children crying, and they say, "Thank God for dead soldiers. Your son's in hell." They have big signs that say these things. This is horrendous. And they don't even follow the Bible much more than anybody else, but they take it that far. A twelve-year-old died of diabetes because it was undiagnosed. She started getting low blood sugar level, getting more and more lethargic, acting strange, ends up going into a coma. And after a month of no treatment, the parents, who had been praying all of that time, finally took the girl to hospital, and she was diagnosed too late and died of diabetes. It's something so simple. It's because the Bible says, "Have faith in the Lord, don't have faith in knowledge, don't have faith in science." This is what happens when you follow the Bible more and more. Look at the situation in Pakistan. I was just reading an article this morning. A man who was mentally disturbed, or rather I should say perhaps mentally retarded, was throwing pages of the Quran out his window, apparently, and he was arrested by the police, and he was being interrogated at the police station, and the mosques were calling out with their megaphones and their public address systems to say, "Go to the police station and make him pay." And so thousands of people show up around the police station and demand that they present him so that they can have a public lynching. The police try to defend him and go through the usual court system, which probably would have resulted in death penalty for him anyway. But this mob destroyed police cars, injured 7 police officers, and finally got access to him, dragged him outside, beat him to death. These are thousands of people in Pakistan just the other day. Beat him to death and then set fire to his corpse for blaspheming a book, which is, you know, pulped wood with a pigment applied. And this is what happens when you follow the Bible. It's morally reprehensible. The only people who don't think it's morally reprehensible are the people who are doing it.
So for Christians, say, in North America and Europe, they claim to follow the Bible, but you're saying that they don't. So where do they get their morality from?
They get it from culture. Originally, the very, very early stages of morality, of course, are evolutionary in origin. But nowadays, we decide. We have, because we have a developed brain and we have the power of speech and the capacity of reason, we say, well, what's moral? What do we call moral? How are we going to progress as a society? We've been doing this for thousands of years. You hear Christians say, Jesus said, do unto others as you would have them do unto you. But Jesus was not the first person to say this. Rabbi Hillel said it a couple of hundred years before Jesus, but as a matter of fact, Confucius in the East and Pittacus, a philosopher, a Greek philosopher in the West, they both said it in the 5th and 6th centuries BCE. They were the ones who came up with the Golden Rule. And so we, because of our self-awareness, it was around the Axial Age, which is 800 to 200 BCE, where philosophers started thinking about, well, I don't want this done to me, so I'm going to guess that you don't want that done to you. And this is the beginning of what we would call moral philosophy and morality, like codifying morality. And it's a very good way of doing it. The Bible is a terrible remnant, which was archaic even for its day. And it's not an appropriate source. And as I say, people claim to follow it because they go, oh, John 3:16, and oh, love thy neighbor, and oh, thou shalt not kill, without understanding that there are 560,000 words in the King James Bible, and probably 500,000 of them are really not worth your time.
What do you make of the people who are selectively following only some advice in the Bible, but not all of it? They only choose to focus on certain things because it's convenient for them. What do you think that they're up to with their reading of the Bible?
Well, I think as I say, if you read something in the Bible with which you agree, you go, oh, that's good, I'm going to follow that. The fact that you can differentiate between love your neighbor and kill your disobedient children, the morality of love your neighbor and the immorality of kill your children, demonstrates that your morality clearly does not come from the Bible, because if you have no other source of morality except the Bible, then you would equally consider that love your neighbor is no more or less moral than kill your children for disobeying, kill your daughter if she's not a virgin on her wedding night, and so on and so forth. We have this capacity, and I've made a lot of progress with a lot of my Christian friends for simply explaining this to people. I have a friend in Shanghai, and we talk about religion a lot. He's a born-again Christian, and I said to him once, you and I are friends because you don't follow the Bible. And he was shocked. He said, oh, well, our friendship has a time limit then. I said, no, it doesn't. He said, what do you mean? I said, well, okay. Abraham had heard a voice in his head in a dream to go and kill, the God said, go and kill your son, your only son, sacrifice him to me. And Abraham did. If you heard a voice in your head that you're certain is God, and it told you to kill a child, even not even your own child, but any two-year-old, would you? And without having to think about it too much, thankfully, he said, no, I have to admit I would not do that, even if I knew it was God telling me to do it. That's why we're friends.
And what about those people out there who would say, you know, those extreme examples from the Bible are remnants of a bygone age, and their religion is more about peace, love, understanding? And for someone like us who would point to these points in the Bible and say, you know, what are these horrible things doing there? For them, it's simply a matter that, oh, it was written a long time ago, and it's not really that important for the morality of their religion.
Yes, well, in that case, why don't they just follow a moral philosophy like secular humanism? If that's what their philosophy is, then my purpose in life for this tour is to explain to them that's indeed how they're behaving. They're living a secular life already. And the Bible is a remnant of their childhood faith, thanks to their parents, most likely. It's not that these people are bad people. It's just that they're misguided. They're misinformed. The Bible is not the source of their morality. They're working it out themselves, and this is a good thing. I'm very glad that people don't follow the Bible. And I want to encourage people not just to not follow the Bible, but to acknowledge and embrace the notion that they already are not following the Bible and that they shouldn't go in that direction.
Well, in the case of somebody who is using the Bible to try to justify a ban on gay marriage, but, for example, not execute somebody who works on the Sabbath, would you conclude that they're simply using the Bible to justify their own homophobia?
Absolutely. Oh, yeah. No, look, the Bible mentions homosexuality a very, very few number of times. It's in the first five books of the Bible. It's mentioned twice. Leviticus 18 says, don't be gay because it's disgusting. That's where I got the title of the book. And Leviticus 20 says, kill anyone who acts gay. And in the same 2,700 years of biblical history, in the smell of burning fat is mentioned seven times. And so, you know, it's burning fat on the altar seems to be a more important thing to discuss in the Bible than homosexuality. Unicorns, in the King James Bible, unicorns are mentioned nine times compared to six times on homosexuality. Unicorns are apparently more important than homosexuality in the Bible. People will develop their philosophy from wherever they like. If they don't like gays, they say, I think gays are icky, then they go and find a passage, an obscure passage in the Bible that says, oh, yeah, I'm allowed to hate gays. Or, in fact, I'm obliged to hate gays. And this is why we have to do away with the Bible. If we're going to burn books, never mind the Quran, we need to start burning Bibles.
Well, that sort of leads to my next question. Do you think that the Bible actually encourages homophobia or bigotry? Or is it that homophobes and bigots just happen to be religious?
That's a good question. I think both. Probably both. Religion generally conditions people to be intolerant of anything that is other, anything that is not the norm, anything that's not the same. Right. Well, even now, even in America, there are colleges which still subjugate women because the Bible says that women are subservient to men. There are plenty of churches that don't allow blacks or Hispanics or Asians. There are churches, of course, that don't allow homosexuals. This bigotry, this intolerance is fueled by the notion that we are the chosen people in one way or another. Whether we're Jewish, because that's why, because the God says that we're the chosen people, or we're the only enlightened Christians because we're born again, or we're the one true Catholic and Apostolic Church. It's always about we are correct and everyone else is incorrect, and everyone different is wrong, and everyone different is evil. This is a common theme throughout most religions, and certainly the Abrahamic religions. Do two things, I suppose. It will fuel a person who's already leaning towards intolerance. It doesn't help them at all with regard to acceptance of other people. But it will also turn normal people into intolerant people, programming them at a very young age, from a very young age. You may be aware of a short video going around the web. A four-year-old standing on a stage in a church singing Romans 1 and 27, ain't no homo gonna make it to heaven. And then this is a four-year-old, the whole congregation cheers. Now, I don't have much hope for that four-year-old for being tolerant and open and welcoming and loving when he grows up. And dare I say, God help him, if it turns out that he's gay, he'll probably kill himself.
And, I mean, I'm curious what your thoughts are on sort of the current religious institutions in the world, the Catholic Church, the Anglican Church. Do you see any signs that these organizations are starting to liberalize a little bit and become a little bit less focused on literal interpretations of Scripture?
Well, I've observed it. I wouldn't say that I'm not surprised. The churches have always been, you know, forced to be dragged along with the rest of society against their will. It's only in the last couple of years that any pope has said, no, it turns out condoms won't send you to hell in every circumstance. This is the same pope, though, who still says that homosexuality is a mental disorder. You know, you look at the Anglican Church, I suppose in America, North America, it's called the Episcopalian Church. They had a synod earlier this year in London. They allowed women priests and gay priests, which sounds very progressive, but the synod was half about whether women, female priests, are allowed to be promoted to bishop. And so, you know, it's not a gender-inclusive company, for example, if you allow women to be hired as janitors, but nothing else. Women are allowed to be deacons and priests. They're not allowed to be bishops. And one of the things they were discussing is, well, what if we allow them to be bishops, but male priests below them can opt to not report to them? This is one of the compromises they're discussing. So they're about the most progressive church, Christian church in the world, for as far as large bodies are concerned. But it's still so far behind the most fundamental concepts of equality that we have in all Western countries.
So why do you think a lot of Western countries point to religion as sort of the shining beacon of morality? Why hasn't more people caught on to this kind of this charade that they're putting on?
I think more and more people are, thanks to the interwebs. I don't think countries actually do it. I think individuals do it. There aren't many countries that have a state religion. Although, interestingly, England is one of those countries that has a state religion. It's not common. In America, of course, we have George Bush, who says, well, I want to appoint common sense judges to the High Court, common sense judges who know that we get our rights from God's law. But fortunately, he's not there anymore. And we have someone who actually wrote books before he got into politics that said, no, if you want to say that abortions are wrong, then you need to give a reason other than because God said so, or because I think God said so, before you can even start having a discussion. And this is a much better way of doing it. It has always been this way, and it's without Christians ever acknowledging it, or without religious people ever acknowledging it, our progression into a more moral system has always been a secular movement.
Well, that actually leads to my next question. What have your Christian friends and the people who are, you know, consider themselves devout Christians responded to you with when you bring up your book and when you give your talks?
Well, I've had nothing but positive feedback. Without reading the book, Christians get offended, but once they read it, they realize what I'm trying to do. I'm trying to explain to people that this is what's in the Bible, and for goodness sake, you know your owner's manual if you want to be this faith. And interestingly, some reviews just by readers on Amazon and Goodreads and have been quite interesting. One person says it's a good way to get the word of God without the boring text. It wasn't my intention, but it certainly is one of the effects. Another person says, as a gay person of faith, I get the humor, and you know, if you're prepared to laugh at your faith, then this is a good book. So I think for the most part, people who have taken the time to start reading it have been quite positive. The ones where I've had negative feedback have only been people who have read the title and not the book. And this is exactly the same person, no doubt, who hasn't read the Bible either. So they're judging a book about a book that they haven't read, which they haven't read, and telling me it's bad. Does that make sense? So they're judging a book they haven't read, which discusses another book they haven't read, and telling me that I'm wrong about it. So
it seems logically consistent with Christianity, though.
Well, a little bit, yes. Christianity does not embrace reason and logic a heck of a lot. It certainly doesn't embrace critical analysis and inquiry, no.
Well, Edward, thank you for joining us on Radio Free Thinker. Your talk is happening Wednesday, July 18th at 7 p.m. and UBC Buchanan Room A103. Could you give us a quick teaser? What can people expect when they arrive at your talk?
Well, I think we've covered the basics. I'll be expanding more on specific points of morality that people insist are from the Bible. I'll be talking about these notions of an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth and the origin of these and the origins of the golden rule. And even the moral parts of the Bible aren't even original to the Bible. When you see love thy neighbor and when you see the golden rule that Jesus says, I'll be discussing exactly where these are from. And they long predate the Bible. So we'll be getting into a lot of that. And I want to spend a bit of time during the talk talking about how to, you know, engage Christians who have these positions. I think it's not enough to just speak to atheists and secular. I want you guys to then go out and say, well, you know, to your friends, there's no doubt that in Vancouver or elsewhere, you always have Christian friends. Engage these people. Have a chat with them. Explain to them. And help them realize they're living a secular life, that it's a good way to live, and that they are not following the Bible, and they shouldn't follow the Bible.
Okay, well, Edward, thank you for joining us, and we look forward to seeing your talk.
Thanks, mate. Oh, look, I just want to mention all the information on the tour and my schedules is on biblicalmorality.com. And my YouTube video is just, on my YouTube channel, rather, is youtube.com/EdwardFarlson. I'm keeping a bit of a video blog as I go around the country.
Standing on a planet. Really, I'm just a speck compared with a star.
Radio Free Thinker is broadcast Tuesdays at 3:30 p.m. on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. You can also hear us Mondays at 8 a.m. on UMFM 101.5 FM in Winnipeg, Fridays at 3 p.m. on CFBX 92.5 FM in Kamloops, and Saturdays at 9 a.m. on CKXU 88.3 FM in Lethbridge. Our thanks to all the stations that broadcast Radio Free Thinker and help promote skepticism and critical thinking. If you would like to have Radio Free Thinker syndicated on your local station, please email us at info@radiofreethinker.com.
We've traveled this way before, and there is much to be learned.
And we're back on Radio Free Thinker here on CITR 101.9 FM. And our thanks to Edward for the interview. We do encourage you to check out his talk, which is coming up on the 18th at 7 p.m., in the Buchanan Building A, Room 103. And I'm sure it'll be a fascinating talk, given that that interview is also fascinating.
Definitely.
Well, we're actually kind of running out of time here on the show, so I suggest we go to our skeptical highlights.
I have one quick one, not so much a highlight, but something to keep your eyes open. It was just brought to my attention recently that Toronto Dominion Bank has announced that if you are Iranian or of Iranian descent, and I'm not sure exactly the details because it's still a bit sketchy, they are closing all your accounts, they're canceling all your mortgages, and they're taking away your credit cards because of current sanctions going on with the Iranian government. Now, again, I'm not sure whether you're a landed immigrant with a, you know, Iranian visa, whether you are a joint citizen, but it seems to be quite a heavy-handed thing. And so far, it's only Toronto Dominion Bank that's doing this. And for those people who sort of, you know, don't want to repeat the errors that we made in World War II with the Japanese internment, where you blame an entire people for something that a nation does somewhere else, it's something to keep your eyes open and be aware about. So just follow the news, keep your eyes open, and don't be afraid to speak up if you think they're crossing the line with that.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. My skeptical highlight is the death of evidence. Yes.
Dun, 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 dun.
So if that sounds grim, well, that's good, because it is grim. This is actually a group of scientists who, I believe today, marched on Parliament Hill in Ottawa. And everyone is concerned because it seems like the Canadian government is trying to kill evidence-based science. And so, I mean, there's a lot of reasons why. We've talked about most of them on the show, but things like scrapping the long-term long-form mandatory census, which, you know, really lowered our ability to get accurate information, ending funding for the Polar Environmental Atmospheric Research Laboratory in Nunavut. That was, you know, a kind of a bonehead move. Cutting the department budgets for Environment Canada, Fisheries, Oceans Canada, the Library and Archives of Canada, National Research Council of Canada, the Statistics Canada, Natural Sciences and Engineering Research Council of Canada, and closing the Experimental Lakes area. We talked about that in the past. Again, all these things really are going to damage our ability to get accurate information about the world around us, so that's very unfortunate. Deciding not to renew the National Science Advisor position, again, like, why? Limiting access of federal government scientists. This was we had a long, ongoing debate with this in the past about whether or not that's a good or bad thing. Ending the National Roundtable on the Environment, which, again, these are just sort of things that there's no really great reason to do these sort of things, and sort of disguising it as, like, budget concerns, I think betrays a lack of understanding of how science will impact our society, making it more profitable and more enjoyable for everyone around. So, you know, these guys are concerned, and it takes a lot to work up Canadian scientists, of all things. And when they're worked up, you know, I think we should be worked up.
Yeah, no, and it's stunning the way, you know, again, I don't want to think of it as sort of conspiracy or some sort of agenda, but you can't help but think that it doesn't follow this. I mean, we've mentioned on several times in the show where there seems to be an exerted effort to sort of diseducate the Canadian populace, to keep them unaware of what's going on. And it's not, again, so much like the money. I mean, we've talked about also on the show that Canada does not have any big fiscal calamity in the war. I mean, everyone's worried about things like Greece and all that. Canada is so far away from that. In fact, if anything, Canada needs to be like other countries and invest more in its economy to stimulate more growth in that particular area. And the amount of money that they're going to be saving from this relative to some of the other boondoggles that they've flipped before. I mean, let us not forget the lake that they made for the G20 or G8, right, which cost tens of millions of dollars, and the money that they're going to be spending on the F-35 planes. And I mean, it's not that they don't have the money. It's something else that's going on that they just don't like people to know.
Yeah. I mean, like, I think that we can – there is a way to attribute this less to an agenda of anti-science, to – an ignorance of how science works. I mean, it's entirely possible that they're all a bunch of, like, morons who don't understand how science is supposed to happen. And that ignorance makes them go, oh, well, we don't need to fund research. That's silly. Like, let's just fund results. Like, that's not how it works, buddy. So, I mean, as we say, this is an important issue, and it's also a good time to remind ourselves that, you know, the next time you vote for a politician, make sure they understand how science works and how science impacts our environment and our lives. So, you know, keep that in mind and keep your eye on the news about this story and see what develops with it. Let that inform you for future decisions.
As the famous saying goes, the only thing evil needs is for good men to do nothing. And, you know, evil can be the light form of evil. I think, again, it's one of those classic fallacies in logic. I have a preset conclusion. And if the facts don't meet with that, there must be something wrong with the facts.
Yeah, absolutely. So, again, keep your ears and your eyes focused on what's happening there.
And don't be afraid to raise a little hell.
Raising a little hell is not bad.
Yes.
It's pretty good, I have to say. Anyway, we're out of time. So this is Ethan, your freethinking historian, saying thank you for listening to Radio Freethinker.
And this is Don saying eyes open, minds on.
If you wish to make an apple pie from scratch, you must first invent the universe.
Thanks for listening to Radio Freethinker. Remember to visit us online at radiofreethinker.com and subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. If you have any local skeptical events you would like us to mention on the air, email us at info@radiofreethinker.com.
Venture to the stars.